Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is Pro Audio brand manager and owner of Dangerous Music and Chameleon Labs, Marek Sykos. But first of all, artists are releasing more formats than they've ever done before. Because of digital competition, artists that appear in Billboard charts are now releasing an average of 9 different formats for every release. For instance, Taylor Swift's Tortured Poets department released 14 vinyl versions alone. And last year, Travis Scott had 84 different versions of his album with different tracks and different track orders. Yes, CDs, vinyl, and cassettes are often sold in box sets and bundles, but there are many fans out there that just want to buy whatever an artist puts out as a collectible. K-pop is very much like that. Fans want to support the artists, and they never plan on playing any of these additional formats that they're buying. But it's not only the top artists on Billboard that are doing this. This has even become a strategy for catalog albums, for instance. The only downside is it requires a whole lot of planning. Obviously, releasing more formats requires more complex marketing and distribution, and inventory can be a nightmare. But the strategy seems to be working, at least for artists that already have some traction. If you have any comments or questions, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can find out all about my books, including The Mixing Engineer's Handbook, Recording Engineer's Handbook, AI for Music Production, The Music Business Advice Book, and more at bobbyosinski.com. There you can also read excerpts from all of my books and learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter. That's bobbyosinski.com. I know you've all heard about tape being dead. Magnetic tape, never have a future. It's dead and gone, but that's not the case. Last year, there were about 500,000 cassettes sold. Yes, music cassettes. And those sales are holding pretty steady. That's not a lot in the grand scheme of things. And it turns out when people talk about 24-track tape machines, well, reel of 2-inch is about $350 if you can find one, and you only get about 14 minutes out of that. However, tape storage is booming. LTO, which is Linear Tape Open, is a tape cartridge format from the late 90s that's still the best way to store data long term. Each cartridge is less than $100 and can store up to 45 terabytes. Yes, that's terabytes with a T. There's even some cartridges that are write once and read many times to prevent accidental erasure. What's more, they last a long time. They're designed to last up to 30 years, but in a controlled environment. The thing that's amazing is the demand for LTO is still growing. The drives are sort of expensive for your home studio, but in the grand scheme of things, they're not, at about $5,000. And the access time is pretty slow. So this format is best for archiving because it's not for data that you have to access often. And it turns out that it's better for the environment than hard drives or even solid-state drives. Whenever you hear about a format being dead, remember that it might be used in another way that you don't know about that's keeping it alive. My guest this week is Marek Sykos, whose company Audio Alchemist acts as a brand manager for a wide range of pro audio manufacturers. He's also the president of the high-end pro audio creators Dangerous Music and Chameleon Labs. Prior to starting Audio Alchemist, Marek worked as director of pro audio at Guitar Center Corporate, where he was responsible for recording, live sound, DJ, and lighting curriculum creation, chain-wide merchandising and department design for all 213 locations, vendor product line and relationship expansion, and more. During our interview, Marek talked about behind the scenes at Guitar Center, the concept behind Audio Alchemist, how brand management for pro audio has changed, gear that feels like making music instead of engineering, and so much more. I spoke with Marek via Zoom from a studio outside of New York City. Let's talk about your background. Let's go back to the beginning. So how did you get into music, and tell me about your journey?
Well, my sister's 10 years older than I am. So at 6 years old, she's playing a guitar. And that to me just seemed like this miraculous, something from another world, as close as I could get to space travel or something, right? So I want to do that. And so my parents gave me a ukulele. Being a rather capricious child, I was like, this has four strings, not six. So I figured out pretty quick that this is not the same as hers. So she gave me some something from the attic that was terribly warped, and like you might imagine, classical guitar. And but that was it. I never looked back. No one ever told me to practice. I just shedded every day. It was one of those things where you just go right down a rabbit hole. And then there was this moment where I must have been about 12, and she came to visit the house with this guy. And my dad at this point, my dad was a professor, but also amateur jazz pianist, photographer, it was a product of that age, and he had very staid ideas about how people look and what they do, whatever, and including musicians, right? He was deep into jazz, beautiful vinyl collection. The only thing I asked for, he said, Mark, what do you want when I pass away? I said, your vinyl collection, Dad. and I have it. So anyway, knock at the door, my sister appears, there's some guy with her, he's got long hair, and my dad was not into, this kind of look, and my sister's got holes in her jeans. He wasn't into this kind of look, but he's like, okay, come in. And she's like, Dad, this is my boyfriend, Bela. He's a great guitar player. And this guy's like, I play banjo. I really don't play guitar. And my sister's like, no. I'm telling you, he's an incredible guitar player. So big argument ensues. He finally agrees to play a song. And we're sitting on these couches, like a big L. And I remember I'm sitting and making the end of that triangle on this little poof, this little cushion, watching. And this guy plays this song. And I went on a journey somewhere else. I was just transported. And when it was over, I'm just sitting there kind of beaming back down onto Earth. And my father, who really never really gave anybody compliments. I mean, I don't remember a good job or anything. My brother and sister don't either, our whole lives. But he said to this guy, that was very good. And then got up and fled. And that was Bela Fleck,
Wow.
Yeah, right. So those were kind of those initial moments. And then at 17, finally, I'm playing rock and roll and, doing the usual things, playing covers and touring, in your local upstate New York, driving down to places that are called like East Monroton, but there's no West Monroton.
Yeah, right.
So places where you're like, where's the bar? And a bunch of guys on motorcycles on their hogs are like, follow us, man. And you follow them to some roadside dive. Anyway, I went into the studio to record a demo, and I remember, we're a rock band, and the drummer had double 24-inch kick drums or whatever, and he's, hits like this, bam, as hard as he can. And so we go in like a rock band, and then I get the tape back, and it's like, boom, boop, 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 doop, 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 doop. Like some sort of country western band or something. I was like, what the hell happened? It was that guy behind the glass. He did it. So that's really what set off my quest to figure out, sort of take control of the sonic journey.
Were you always the guy that would set up the PA because there's always one guy in the band, that takes care of all the sound and everything.
No, we were really lucky. In college and high school, I had friends, I was in theater a little bit. And so made friends with the people that everybody always blew off, when people that did the lighting and the sound that everybody ignored, because we're the stars, right? And I was fascinated with what's going on over there. What are those people doing? So became friends with those people. And so those people ultimately became, our sound people on the road. So I'd always want to know, but they're like, no, we got it. We got it. And they would always set these crazy systems up. I mean, that's back in the day, man, when they're climbing into into the air conditioning to try to get, 220 volts out of the system. And I, guys would climb up the telephone pole and jack into it. I'm serious.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Those guys, you know, to try to run the PA system. So, so no, it wasn't. I was always more of the studio rat. You know, I was, I was doing, you know, Les Paul sound on sound. My mother was a professor of romance studies. So she had language lab. So she had a tape recorder, cassette recorder. And then my dad had one for dictation, right? So I would record onto my mom's and then play back through the speakers and play along with it into my dad's, you know, and do things like that. So even at that age, it was more recording than live sound. I mean, I was selling door-to-door hi-fi at the age of 12, selling, you know, cartridges and, you know, stuff. Hey, man, you want to buy a needle?
Yeah, but back in the day, though, that was a big deal. That, you know, you could do that. Yeah. Everybody had a hi-fi system, so yeah, you can do it.
Oh yeah, no. Well, I still have a great hi-fi system. I still love. You know, yeah. I mean, part of the reason I bought my house, you know, obviously my studio's here, and it had to sound good. But the realtor, you know, I'm walking around in the corner, is going clapping and stuff. And at some point, she takes my wife aside. And she's like, are you pre-approved for financing? She's thinking I've just wasted my Sunday with these crazy people, you know, barking in a house. Yeah. You know?
Okay. So let's get into your journey then in the audio business. Where did that start? I saw something somewhere about you worked at LaSalle Music, and that brought back some memories for me.
Oh yeah, man. I put myself through college. I had a scholarship, but you still have to pay for books and housing and all this extra stuff, right? So I put myself through school selling shoes at this place, Fontana Shoe Store in Ithaca, New York. It's still there. And I was the manager. I became the manager. I got a raise from $4.25 to $4.50 to manage this place. And then when I went off to seek my fortune to play rock and roll, my day gig was selling clothes. I managed a Chess King, you know, out in Boston. So a headhunter came through, and back then there were just people that showed up, and they were like, hey, you know, you seem pretty sharp. You know, what if I could get you an extra $10,000 a year working somewhere else, you know, like at a CVS, you know, or something else. Right. And I'm like, man, I don't see myself working at a CVS. And this one guy just took it upon himself and said, you know what? I've called up all the local music stores and found out the names of the managers, and that's where you need to work, man, because you understand retail and you understand music. So you need to work in a music store. So I was like, okay, thanks, man. You know, I'm 21 years old. So I wander off to various music stores, and I remember them laughing at me when I'm coming in applying for a job, because they're just like, dude, someone dies before you get a job here.
Yeah,
it's going to be a friend of a friend that's going to get the gig. I mean, I'm still friends with those people that I remember their faces as I was walking in, you know? But then I got this weird call. I was living in this, what they called the House of Rock, with a guy that was 10 years plus older than me, who was in a super heavy metal band, you know, not yet into metalcore, but, you know, approaching that. And so it was a wild ride, parties every night. And I'm trying to keep this modicum of decency and try to get a job over here. And he's answering the phone. I won't tell you, but it's, you know, super off color comments when you answer the phone.
Yeah.
And so he uses one of those House of, you know, just fill in the blank with something. And it's this guy on the other end, Mark Parsons. And he wants to, I'd like to interview for a job for selling pro audio at LaSalle Music. Like, I think it's a joke. I'm thinking Parsons, like, you know, someone's making a joke about mixing Dark Side of the Moon or something. They're picking on me here, you know, but it was real. I'm like, why would you pick me? I know nothing about pro audio. I know about guitars. He's like, well, you were an English major and I was an English major too, so I think you could learn this. So I went down to LaSalle Music and got $200 a week, right?
Yeah.
To work there. And he sent me off with one of the various recording books. Wasn't yours. It might have been the Yamaha recording book, and sent me to the park and said, go read this for the first week. And, you know, nothing made any sense whatsoever. And then I was on phones. He gives me a desk in the basement that's got three legs. One leg's broken. And he's like, here's all the leads that your former guy was following. And I'm like, well, if that guy quit, he obviously sucked. I'm not going to pursue any of these dead ends. I'll start from scratch. So I just went to the library and photocopied all the music schools around the country. And then just called every single music school and got to their music department and started selling stuff. And people could not understand how some, you know, really idiot, right? I was completely ignorant. People would call up and say, they would ask me, do you have NS10Ms? And I'd be like, by who? And click.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Just hang up the phone, right? I knew nothing. But little by little, I learned. And LaSalle, it was apparent, was having financial difficulties. It was going out of business. And I got offers like at E. Wurlitzer down the street from Fritz. I got a job offer, but I stayed because people like Eric Blackmer and Elliot Vasquez and all these guys were there that knew about stuff. I didn't know anything. You know, I'm like, here's a console. It's a spaceship. How do I control? I still remember Elliot telling me, well, dude, it's kind of like, you know, these are all the people, these channels, and they'll get on the bus together, right? And I was like, wow, this guy could actually explain this. I want to be able to explain things to people, you know? And so I stayed there even as the ship was going down because I was learning so much from, you know, from these amazing engineers and minds at the time.
Wow. How did you get to Guitar Center?
Oh, man. So LaSalle, I got a call from Eric Blackmer, you know, who's, you know, his dad started DBX, David Blackmer, the DB and DBX and Earthworks and all this, you know, brilliant guy. I never got to meet him, but Eric is still a friend to this day. And his brother is a brilliant studio designer, Michael. And so I got a call on the 4th of July from Eric and he said, hey dude, don't come to work today. There's a padlock on the door. And so I guess, I won't get into the story and conjecture, you know, or lore of what happened, but essentially they were closed at that point. So I had to get a job. And by this point, I was feeling kind of cocky, right? There are points in your career in audio where you actually think you really think you've got it figured out. And that's exactly the point where you don't know shit. You know, it's when you think you've got it figured out, you don't know anything, right? So I'm at that dangerous point where I think I know what's going on. So I actually went up to Steve's Quality Instruments in Danvers, Massachusetts, and told the owner, you know, you need to hire me. And he said, hire you? I just fired somebody. I'm like, yeah, you fired them because they suck. You're going to hire me because I'm good and I'm going to sell product for you. And I'm so confident I'll work here for free for 2 weeks.
Wow.
And that's what I did. And at the end of 2 weeks, he was going to fire me. And his wife told him, Steve, I know he's not selling anything. Don't fire him. He's preparing to sell because I was organizing everything. I cut every cable for the speaker wall so everything would suddenly function on a switcher. You know, I was organized the literature, the cabinets, made the guitars all tuned, you know, whatever, got the place dialed and then crushed it. And then I became the store manager. I thought the guy was going to fire me. He puts me up in the little practice room. Our knees are touching. And I'm like, I thought he was going to let me go. He's like, I think we see eye to eye. Why don't you manage the store? I was like, oh my God, you know, whatever. Now I'm 22 or 23 or something. So then I gave myself to 26 to be a rock star, right? And woke up one morning and, you know, we were having really good success, but I woke up one morning and just decided that I felt like I didn't like music anymore. It was a terrible, horrible realization. It was just, I woke up with this feeling, I don't like music. How is that possible? It's been all that's been driving me my entire career. You know, we've been playing at this point. I'd built a recording studio in Boston. We've got this band, which is arguably like the number one thing happening there. I've got, you know, the record labels want to come see it. And here I am taking everything apart, right? Just saying, I don't like music, so I'm not going to do this. And so I have to make a life change. So I decide, I'm going to move to LA and I'm going to become a producer, right? I don't have the R because I'm not good. So I'm a producer. And so that's really the moment where, you know, you put everything in your van, you take apart your recording studio, you drive across the country, you're going through a lot of soul reckoning. And I was going, I went to IRS Records. IRS Records told me I could use the room on spec. I had some of the guys from World War III, the lead singer from World War III, and Jakey, the guitar player from
Jakey Lee
from Ozzy. Jakey Lee. They had a thing they were working on. I met with them. They wanted to do it. I was going to get to engineer this project. You know, I got the room on spec at IRS Records, but the tipping point was buying the tape. They couldn't afford the 2-inch. I was rubbing 2 coins together in my pocket, buying, you know, white cans with blue lettering, B-E-E-R, you know, generic. I mean, I'm at the bottom, right? You know, I'm having to borrow like $2 off my girlfriend, right? I'm like, I've never been a person like that. I've always paid my own way. So I'm like, I got to get a job today. So I went and interviewed, and people don't remember this, but Ventura Boulevard in L.A. used to be music store mecca.
Yeah.
You know, there was Joe Goodman's, there was Guitar, there was Guitar Center, there was Nadine's. I mean, you just drove down the street to get your deal. So I did that. I went down the street and interviewed. Of course, I've got enough experience at this point, so I got offered the jobs at all the places. But I decided, well, I only need a gig for like 2 weeks anyway until I get one of these studio jobs, because I'm New York, so I'm used to people saying F off, where these people are Californians. So they're saying, yeah, this sounds great, man. Thanks. You know, this sounds real good, which is the same thing. I just didn't know how to translate it yet. So I'm thinking something's imminent. So I took the job at Guitar Center thinking, okay, I'll be here for a couple of weeks. It's kind of a corporate company. I mean, I've never worked, you know, I'm used to working for Ma and Pa's and, you know, knowing the owner, working independently. So that's how I got into that incredibly, the most dysfunctional company, you know, I've ever worked for. And, you know, at that time, the most dysfunctional company I've ever had the pleasure of working with, you know. Yeah. After my first day, I came home and my girlfriend's like, how was it? I said, I'm never going back. And 15 years later, I left.
Wow, that long, huh?
Yeah. And in Guitar Center years, you know, you multiplied by 7. Yeah. So it's like, that's Malthusian. Yeah. Malthusian age.
Yeah. Okay. So what happened then?
Yeah. So while I was at Guitar Center, what happened was an explosion of cultural change, right? I got there and it was like us against the customer. And I had never experienced such a thing before. You know, everybody that shopped with me were my friends. We all played rock and roll together. You know, it was like you found a cool, like, whatever, DR, I think, had just started coding a string or something. You know, I was like, dude, check this out. We've got this technology, you know, whatever. Anything that was new. I was selling Rocktron and Intellifexes and Intelliverbs, you know, $1,000 effect processors to guitarists, you know, street people like me. You didn't pay your rent so you could buy your gear.
Yeah,
you know, right?
Yeah, right.
You drove the oldest car in the history of humanity so you could have cool gear. I was selling stuff like that because there's no patch paws or whatever. I mean, we're sharing all the secrets together. That's what a music store was about, was like, you know, you learn what's cool, what's not, and they learn stuff on the street, and then you share all that tribal knowledge. The opposite was happening at Guitar Center. A guy walked in, and we didn't have a price on anything. There's no prices, and a guy would say, how much is that? And you'd say, how much do you want to pay?
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
That's what you were supposed to say. And I'm like, dude, I'm just not going to do that because that's not me. And that's so abnormal. I mean, read any psychological book, you know, study. This is not how humans are going to build a friendship. You know? So I did the opposite. I would tell people the price, and then this giant fight would ensue because I didn't understand that's what Guitar Center had set up. So no matter what number came out of my mouth, the customer would automatically say, what do you think? I'm an idiot. You think I was born yesterday? What are you talking? So I had to overcome this culture. And I actually remember a moment standing behind the counter and a guy's buying 2-inch tape. And he's like, how much for the 2-inch tape? And I tell him, like, $135 or something, you know, and he's like, come on, Matt. And he starts to go in the thing and the routine. And there's a line of like 3 or 4 of the people behind him waiting who know me. And they go, excuse me, this is how it works now. Marek's totally straight up. That's the price. they corrected the guy. They educated him, you know? And at that time, Guitar Center went to suddenly, let's actually put GLP, you know, guaranteed lowest price, which we called God's lowest price, right? You know, so on the products. And so the culture really changed. And then they went into this expansion phase. So for me, no one's really been able to successfully manage me unless they know to give me a lot of rope to hang myself or to be successful, right? So that time to that expansion, it was a great period because I printed up business cards with a title, you know, like regional technology manager. You know, I spent my own money to make the card. No one questioned this title at the company. You know, it's like, yeah, Mark's the guy. He's the regional technology manager. It says on his business card, you know? So I was going to leave and start a music school, an audio school. And last minute, Guitar Center convinced me, go to Miami, spend a year down there. Then we'll move you to New York. We know you want to get back to New York. And I knew it was, you know, you always multiply by at least two with Guitar Center. So it's going to be at least 2 years. So I went down there and opened up these stores in Hallandale, Florida. It's like they already had Mars Music already beat us to it. Sam Ash already beat us to it. They already had another long-standing music store down there. So there was like zero business. There were crickets down there. And they built this huge facility with all this gorgeous equipment. And so because I had worked at Mom Pa's, I went old school. I went like, let's lift every stone. So we were doing things like I would have guys driving gear out to the cruise ships, right? We would get accounts with those guys because they don't want to buy anything good because it gets destroyed by salt.
Yeah, sure.
So they would buy the cheapest drum kits and the cheapest everything, but they would always buy more stuff. You know what I mean? Every cruise. So I had guys driving out there. We were faxing customers at that time deals. I mean, it's like just the internet was barely born. This is like 1996, you know? So we were the only part of the company that was successful was Pro Audio. My guys were on the top of the store. Everybody else was really struggling because they're just waiting for people to come in. We knew nobody was going to come in the shop. And then I started managing Kendall or sort of overseeing the guys down there, which I didn't understand this about Latin culture and having spent time in South America and Central America. You'd think I would know something, but I knew nothing. I'm there in the store and there's a guy shouting, you know, you're from Argentina, so you are entitled. I'm from Guatemala. So I live on the streets, you know, across the customers, you know, and I'd just take them out and feed them beer. And then they became friends, you know, the great elixir. So I did that. Yeah. I was like, they just kept expanding, opened 50 stores and, you know,
that was a great adventure for you. So then, okay, after Guitar Center, you went on your own, right? Right away.
Yeah. Yeah. I took 8 months off because my brain was mush. That's what happens. I was jumping time zones like Houdini, you know, going to Hong Kong. So I'm 12 hours. My clock is 12 hours off. Then I'd fly home. Then I would go to Seattle and I'm 3 hours off from New York. And so my brain was really degaussed. So I took 8 months off, and after I did this canoe adventure trip across Mongolia, that's my alter ego is an outdoors person. I was ready to work, you know? And so Audio Alchemist kind of came out of this mess. I actually was developed a phone app so people could come in stores and take pictures and do all their stuff and send it up to a cloud, which didn't exist then. But my buddy that was doing it, all the software development went out to some Russians that didn't actually deliver. So that didn't happen. But I mean, it was super forward thinking. I mean, that would have been, I think that I probably wouldn't be in the music business anymore if I had seen that through correctly. But yeah, so I started a company, Audio Alchemist, and the concept wasn't a rep firm. The concept was a brand management company. And the difference is, I only represent brands that I love, that I want to use, and I want to be in your family for forever. And the idea is that, you know, take a company like Manly, like Avana was trying to hire a sales manager. And I said, look, you can't afford someone great full time. So hire someone great part time and I'll be that person for you. I'll be your sales manager. We'll do everything that we have to do. If we have to decide how to promote a product, we have to figure out what's wrong with a manual. You know, today it's all about social media and marketing and we do all that kind of stuff. So that's really where I took it. And that was a difficult concept to get across to the industry, right? They were used to, oh, you're a rep. Yeah. Sell this much, make this much. It's like, no, we're not going to work that way. We're going to work in a way that's symbiotic. I'm one of your employees, even though I'm a 1099 on a W-2, but I'm going to work as hard as if I was in the building with you every day. And so that's really where Audio Alchemist came from.
You know, the other thing about that is as soon as you mention brand, people's eyes glaze over because they just don't understand what it, most of them don't understand what it is.
Yeah, right. What is a brand? What is my brand?
Yeah.
Or no.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's very true. So that was a long journey and it's changed. That was 2008. Here we are, you know, 16 years later. And you know, social media is so critical, but at the same time, people have social media fatigue, right? So it's almost like it's hit its plateau and it's like, oh man, people are getting off social media. You know, I own this company. We do all this social media. I don't get on it. I don't check Instagram or Facebook every day. I'm just not there. I have to force myself to say, hey, how is this thing doing? Go look at the numbers, that sort of stuff. But so it's an ever evolving thing. And the bottom line we have to remember is it's about music. You know, this is all a big distraction. You know, I want to, you know, when I do my tour, like last year, I hit like 25 cities in the United States with $180,000 worth of equipment. You know, we roll up and we take over a beautiful room someplace, you know, in the United States. And you know all the major cities, and somebody cries in that audience when I play them something, you know, and that's the moment, right? I think we're hitting a moment of misophonia. So just like we're learning about light pollution and how we have to reduce this light pollution, it's messing up our lives, our everything from our circadian rhythms to birds to how we sleep. I think misophonia, like all these trucks backing up, beep, 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 you know, and incredibly loud vehicles. I mean, New York City has finally put microphones up, right? They're listening. And if you violate that noise ordinance with your ridiculous car, you're going to get punched. I think we need to make music, not just a right that everybody can just have everywhere. Like it shouldn't be in an elevator. It shouldn't be in a dentist's office. It shouldn't be on your call waiting on your phone. It's like, get rid of all that, man. Make it special again, you know, and, you know, make people have to seek it out and make it great quality while you're there. Move people. I'm, you know, a lot of people might complain about Taylor Swift. The other half of the people love Taylor Swift. For me, I'm thrilled about Taylor Swift. I'm not a Swiftie, but I'm thrilled that many people want to go to a concert. To me, that's great that the people want to hear live music. You know, it's like, that's fantastic. So I'm, that's kind of, you know, what I look for towards the future. We make products that try to capture everything. You know, everything I do, all the brands I work with is all about getting the best product for somebody, the most realism. And then you can be creative and mess it up and do whatever you want with it, right? Because those are stylistic choices. But I at least want to get that reality to you first, right? So that's in your hands and then you can play with it. And that's ultimately what accesses our emotions at the end of the day. I want to get to people's hearts. And I think just like we were talking about getting tired of social media or getting tired of whatever, I think, you know, we're going to have a return to originality that we're going to hear. Like a lot of voices sound similar today, right? I think, you know, people say, why is Adele popular? Well, because she sounds a little different than other people.
Like Adele,
you know?
Yeah, like, right.
Yeah, right. You know who she is. Or, you know, we could pick a bunch of amazing artists like that. I mean, Glenn Hughes, the guy's in his 60s and he's finally having a career, right? He's like, I think he's at the top. I think sounds the best he ever has, you know? So I think I'm looking forward to that, and I want to create tools to that end. So to me, it's about music. You know, I travel with 7 terabytes of music on the road. It's all CD or higher resolution. I don't have a Spotify account. I use Tidal if I need to stream. And I'm just out there, man, I'm just out there. I'm a preacher, you know, preacher for audio.
Chameleon Labs. How did that come about?
Chameleon Labs was completely unexpected. So the funny thing is, so when I bought Dangerous Music, everybody comes out of the woodwork because they're like, oh, maybe this guy can solve all my problems. Cut me a big check and I can quit. Right.
Yeah. Right.
So I got a call through a friend. Hey, Chameleon Labs is looking to sell. And I said, well, that's nice. What's up with you?
Yeah, right.
And it took 2 more tries to get this thing to start. And here's really why. So I wanted, you know, Dangerous Music has a very specific mission out there, very specific mission statement. It comes from the world of mastering. You know, Neve brought us character. SSL brought us workflow. And Dangerous opened the kimono to the mastering world and brought it to everybody. So now you have this transparency and musicality, and I would call, you know, I call it audiophilia, this super high fidelity. So you've got that beautiful triumvirate of 3 things coming together there. So that's what's expected of Dangerous Music. And that costs a lot of money to develop. You know, I'm into $250,000 on this next product that we're working on. Chris Muth and I are sitting here listening to these boards, and we're like, if these don't work, the product is scrapped, right? And we went through 6 revisions. Every revision is 10 grand. And the first one was unlistenable. And I was like, do we quit now? He's like, no, I think we can, you know, he's got the faith. Then I've got the faith. But anyway, so what happened is I also wanted a place where I could put wacky ideas because I'm a wacky human being. So that's not going to go with Dangerous. Dangerous has stayed. Dangerous, you know, you could buy any box in the line and you're going to know it's transparent yet musical and versatile. It's got to fit those 3 parameters, right? So wacky doesn't necessarily go in there. So I was going to start this company, Collaborative Audio Labs. And the Collaborative Audio Labs was just to be all the people that I know out there that bring me wild ideas. When they've got a good one, it's like, dude, let's do it, right? And it's a different brand, a different play space. Don't have to worry about messing up the Dangerous name. And it would just be something else. Maybe it's a, you know, maybe it's a brain powered kazoo. I don't know, you know, something. And so then I suddenly realized that Collaborative Audio Labs was C-A-L and Chameleon Labs was C-L. It was almost the same. And Chameleon changes, right? And I wouldn't have to struggle to get this brand into Sweetwater and Guitar Center and Vintage King and all the, it's already there, right? Because that's always a big grind too. It's like, I've got this new thing.
Yeah.
Care. So that's how it started. And then I realized that the work that Marcelo had done going into the really 2.5 existing products was extreme. I'm looking at the documentation. I mean, Manly doesn't have this level of detail. Dangerous doesn't have this level of detail. It's like unbelievable level of documentation and the bombs and the studies and everything is so immaculate and well-organized. And I can see why they wanted to sell, because he's not a sales guy. He's an engineer, right? So it's like, hey, what should we work on today? We work on marketing? I don't think so. What about sales? I don't know. How about engineering? Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, right.
So I've got these beautiful products that I have a marketing plan, which I haven't had the bandwidth to execute, but it's all in my head and it's started. to get the story out there to humanity. But yeah, that's how that came about, you know, was really almost like through a mistake, you know?
All right. What's the one thing about what you do that you wish people knew, or maybe they misunderstand?
That I care. Like it's my own kids. I mean, the expense that we put in and the late nights and everything that we do is for one goal, is to make, you know, better products so that people can capture their music. And what I mean by that is I want to capture their music agnostically. So this is not a hip hop box. This is not a rock box. You know, this is not a jazz box. This captures everything, all of the essence of you. And then you can take with it and mess it up and play with it and make it dirty or make it bright or make it up front or lay back or whatever you feel. But I want to give you the tools to get you to that first stage. Cause you know, you remember like recording on a four track, you couldn't get to the first stage. Everything started like this.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's like, it was your song, but it's, you know, it just didn't feel that it didn't have the impact and stuff. So I think it's the love that goes into it and the passion about wanting to get these tools in people's hands. You know, people would be surprised. You know, I'll do a support call. I had a guy over here, customer, he's got a Slam and he's got a Manly Slam and he's got a Manly Variable Mu, right? And he doesn't know how to use them. He's like, I don't think they're working. So he's nearby, you know, in Jersey or something. I said, just come by, man. We plug it in, show him how to use it. He tells me what he's trying to do. He sent me a text message last night. I can show you the pictures. He's gone out and bought, you know, a Manly L-op. You know, he's added to his collection. He's added a Dangerous Compressor, a Bax, a Liaison. You know, it's like he figured it out. He could sit here and he brought his music. He's like, that's what I've been trying to do. You know, it's like, great. So I want to create workflow, transparency, control, versatility to people's lives. I don't want it to feel like it's engineering. I'm a guitar player. I want it to feel like it's like making music. You're sitting there and it's easy. You're turning knobs. It feels good. You turn the knob until it feels good. You could probably go too far if you're me, and then you bring it back to where it's right.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah, right.
That's what I want.
Last question. What's the best piece of advice that maybe you learned along the way or somebody imparted to you?
Wow, just generic advice? Oh.
Well, something that was really important to you.
Okay, well, a big one was leave your baggage at the door. Right, I learned that in college, in retail. I'm coming in and I'm stressed out about my girlfriend or school or whatever, you know, and so I'm bringing that garbage into the workplace with me. And the owner said to me, I was going down to Florida for the holidays, see my grandparents. And he said, hey, while you're down in Florida, if you see that guy I hired, send him back up here. And if you don't, don't come back. Right. And there was another employee that was standing with me that witnessed this whole thing. And he was like, he can't say that to you, you know, and he was going off. And I looked at him, I said, he's right. He's paying for this, but he's getting that. And so work became partially an escape, right? But I realized you got to do something that you love, because you're going to spend more time at work than you are with your significant other, you know? So you better try to tie your passions in somehow to that thing that you're going to spend so much time doing. And when you get there, I don't want to know about your car, you know, breaking down. I mean, I do with my employees, but I'm saying in general, the person that's hiring you doesn't want all that extra stuff. They just want you. They want your brilliance. They want, you know, what you can bring to the table. So that's been important to me. And I've screwed that up in relationships too, because it doesn't end with work. It's like you don't come in and then you just lay all that on your significant other's doorstep, all your trash, That's what's for drinking with the boys at the bar after work is for. They can all complain about the same thing. You want to share the good times and the bad times with your significant other, but man, give them the good times. They deserve it. They've been with you through thick and thin. They deserve the wins.
You can find out more about Merrick and Audio Alchemist at audioalchemist.com. That's audioalchemist.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at bobbyosinski.com. There, you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Apple Music, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.